This is CliffCentral.com.
Well, we're going to get into something now that I think a lot of people are very, very interested in. I think, you know, there's this constant search for meaning in the world, and there are so many young people who are just bored with what's going on in politics and society. They don't want to be part of what everyone else is part of just because everyone else is part of it. And I think people are also looking for what it is that defines them. Some people tend to define themselves by collective nouns. They like to say they are white or black, they are male or female, they are rich or poor, they are old or young, and they start to define themselves by those things. I've always thought it was more interesting to meet someone who describes themselves by adjectives. I think I wrote about this in my book, that if someone comes up to you and you say, "Tell me about yourself," and they immediately give you obvious things like, "I'm a woman," or "I'm black," or I don't find that interesting. I can see that for myself. If they start saying, "I have a sense of humor," "I laugh when people fall," "I read a lot of books," "I'm interested in biology." Those are the kinds of things you want to hear from someone when they describe themselves, right? Not the demographics. And demographics are what got us into a situation in this country called apartheid, which did nobody any good on either side of the spectrum. And I'm always a bit nervous about groups. I'm always a bit nervous about being co-opted into groups. I'm always a bit nervous about being stereotyped by a group that people think I'm a part of when I haven't volunteered to be a part of that group. People assume a whole lot of things about you. And I suppose our guest this morning is of the same kind of bent. His name is Trevor Watkins. He's the co-founder of something called the Individualist Movement. So he started reading Ayn Rand in the early 1980s, which for some people on the left is an instant dead giveaway that he must be some kind of evil monster. Because Ayn Rand is, of course, the author of Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, and a number of other really interesting books. If you've ever read the biography of Ayn Rand, you'll realize that this was a woman who escaped Soviet Russia. She had a very harsh life under the Soviets. She went to America and rebuilt her life from scratch. She had a very strong and independent streak about her that made some people nervous. But in her time, she was reviled by some, and she was canonized and lionized by others. So I'm interested to hear what Trevor has to say about her. But he became a keen libertarian after reading Ayn Rand's books and became involved with the individualist movement ever since. Simply put, libertarians, and I think many people in the world are starting to identify as libertarians, believe that people should be able to do whatever they want as long as their actions don't harm others. As a result, libertarians want to limit the government's power and authority so that people can have as much freedom as possible. So we'll talk a little bit about libertarianism, individualism. We'll talk a bit about capitalism. We'll talk about what freedom means for an individualist. And our guest this morning is Trevor Watkins. What a pleasure to meet you, Trevor. Properly, you say we met before.
Yeah, it's great to be here. It's lots of fun to be in front of a microphone again, I must say.
Well, I'm sorry that we met before and I don't remember. Was that my fault? Was I not paying attention?
You were giving the speeches. I was sitting in the audience. I think it's okay. Forgivable.
Well, thank you. I'm very pleased you're here today, though. So today you're the one who's speaking. I'm in the audience. The individualist movement, you're a co-founder there. How did this come about?
It's fairly new. It's really only 9 months old at this stage.
Uh-huh.
I've, as you said, been a libertarian for about the last 35 years. And around about January, February of this year, I, thinking about the state of the libertarian world and that sort of thing, and it occurred to me that the communists have a communist manifesto. It runs to, I think, 20 or 25 pages. The ANC and many others in South Africa have the Freedom Charter.
Yeah.
The Americans have their Constitution and Bill of Rights. But if you ask a libertarian, you know, what document do you hold up as a quick and easy answer to the question, who are you and what are you, then mostly we don't have a good answer.
I start talking a lot.
Yeah, we start giving examples. Yeah. You know, if I punch you in the nose, that's an indiscretion, etc., etc.
Yeah.
But there wasn't one simple document. And as And understanding that you don't like joining the groups, the Libertarian Society, which has been around since 1986, is a non-group. I would really like to think so.
Yeah, it's like being a bald person at a hairstyles convention.
I'm not too sure that I follow it. But
the idea being that there are all these different kinds of hairstyles. Most libertarians don't want rules or memoranda or agendas or belonging the way that people in other groups might want that.
I think that we're more like being an engineer at a hairstylist's convention.
Okay. That's a better analogy.
In other words, we try not to fit into boxes.
So how do you define it? First, let's start off with the definition. So how do you define libertarian? How do you define an individualist?
Right.
What's the difference?
Not a lot of difference. Mm-hmm. Except perhaps that an individualist would say, this is what I am, and this is the individualist manifesto that I dreamt up in about February of this year, purely as an answer to the Communist Manifesto, to the Freedom Charter. Mm-hmm. I wanted a document which laid out what I, as a libertarian, required of myself relative to others, and what I would require of others relative to me. And it ended up with a little bit of jiggery-pokery, being four words, each beginning with R.
Okay. What are the four words?
And they're emblazoned on my chest, but your listeners can't see that. But they are respect, request, recognize, and resolve. And they really have to be taken in a slightly longer context.
Go on.
Which is respect me, respect my independence, request my consent, recognize my property, and resolve disputes by a jury. And I would like to think, subject to discussions like this, that this pretty much covers all the cases that it takes for an individual to live in the world peacefully and cooperatively. And perhaps the biggest problem with the libertarian definition, which tends to be what is called the non-aggression axiom or principle, mm-hmm. which is...
That's the one I read out earlier, that you, as long as you don't harm others, you can do what you like.
Yep. And there's a problem with that, and we did feel as libertarians the need to resolve that problem, which is that would outlaw rugby, boxing, mm-hmm. kung fu, because there are often cases when you do want to harm others and where you consent to be harmed, and consider this an interesting competitive organization or arrangement. So if you just adopt the non-aggression principle, you exclude a whole range of human experience. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, we in South Africa have developed an alternative to the non-aggression principle, which is called the consent axiom, which we think is by and large unique in libertarian circles in the world.
What is that?
Well, obviously the Americans and many other constitutions operate on the consent of the governed, and so that word is a very important part of those constitutions. But the consent axiom very briefly says, you may take no action against me to which I do not consent.
A murderer, just off the bat here, won't necessarily consent to being acted against by the criminal justice system.
Yes, and it has to be extended, except in cases where you have already taken action against me without my consent. So there is an extension to that. We try and keep it short. It's really just four words, no action without consent. But there has to be the extension, except when you have aggressed against me or violated my consent.
Okay.
And in those circumstances, all bets are off, essentially.
I'm always interested in why the libertarians haven't gained much of a foothold, especially in developed Western democracies like America. I mean, there are good reasons to be libertarian. It seems to me that that's the most free possible scenario for a human being to be in. And we talk about freedom, and we talk about liberty, and we talk about all of these things which are regarded in the West as being great things that we should all aspire to. Yet libertarianism just hasn't been able to take off. And it's always mischaracterized by, you know, whack jobs and people who are philosophers and people who tend to stand for a whole lot of numinous things that can't really be defined very well. Mm. Whereas the left and the right and a number of others in between, like the green parties or whatever, it's clear to people what they stand for. It's not so clear to people what libertarians are. Is that our fault as libertarians?
Well, everybody is in favor of freedom.
Yeah.
You look at every single...
I mean, you talk about respect. Who's against respect? I mean, who in the world goes, you know what? I'm dead against respect. It's not a good idea.
The vast majority of people in government?
Well, let's take them out of this for a minute, because we know that they're mostly parasitic.
Yeah.
The idea of requesting seems to me to be civil and more. If I want something from you or if you want something from me, we request politely.
The absolute definition of what we believe is good manners.
Well, there we go.
Yeah. People just simply behave to recognize, in a mannerly way.
To recognize your rights is to recognize my rights. That's Ubuntu in some way.
Yes.
So who could be against that? The idea of if you have property, I must recognize that that's your property and respect it, going back to respect. And similarly, if you do the same to me, who could be against that?
It becomes a problem when you put a collective slant on it. In other words, if a collective, whatever it may be, let's say a democracy, 51% of people
mm-hmm.
make a decision about my life, I am bound by it.
Yeah, which is not right.
They don't ask my consent. They just simply say, we're a majority.
We're going to impose.
We'll impose taxes, laws, take your property, etc.
People are perfectly happy to go with that kind of situation if they're in the 51%. Mm. If they're in the 49%, they rebel against it at all costs.
Not necessarily. It would appear, and there's lots of studies to show it, is that the vast majority of people are quite happy being told what to do. They're quite happy being lumped into a collective. We hunt down collectives with great enthusiasm, so we belong to churches and clubs and schools and things like that.
Well, maybe that's the problem, right? Like, that's where I fall off the averages. And you can help me try and define this a little bit better, and you can help me to understand your position, and hopefully in that, many of us who might be listening to this who are confused. Why do we want to belong so desperately? Why is it important to collectivize? And why in human history has this been shown to bring about so much suffering?
It's interesting. We have discussed that at some length within the sort of libertarian group. Most people say it goes back to our hunter-gatherer roots. If you want to bring down a mammoth and you rush out as a single person with a spear, you're going to fail. If you can get two or three of you, you're probably still going to fail. If you can get 50 or 60 of you, there's a good chance you can kill the mammoth and eat for a month. And that is, many people feel, the origin of collectives. And we're certainly not against collectives. Almost everything useful that humans do, they do as a collective. But when they decide, or that collective decides, that it has more rights than the individual, that it can override the rights of the individual, that's where we fall off, and I'm sure that's where you fall off.
Has there ever been a society, and we'll come back to my last question about suffering in a minute, but has there ever been a society where individual rights have trumped collective rights every time?
There's been a couple. One could call America the original one. The first 100 years of the American experiment was a wonderful exercise in individual rights by and large. It simply got betrayed around about the beginning of certainly this century. Amusingly, the other day I read that one of the greatest villains in history was Woodrow Wilson, who seemed to be part of a collective, you know, Lenin, Stalin, Marx and Woodrow Wilson, but he put in place a surprisingly number of bad things and pretty much put an end to the American experiment.
I didn't realize he was such a bad guy.
Yes, nobody does. The vast majority of people not say when did he live.
I knew he was the president who was there around the Treaty of Versailles.
Yep.
And when America, obviously, just prior to that, entered World War I.
But on his watch, income tax was sought for the first time. The Federal Reserve was created. And, yeah, the Treaty of Versailles.
What was his purpose? What was his overriding ideology?
He was basically a conservative, perhaps one would say, a tool of the industrial class. I don't really know him that well myself. As I say, the vast majority of people would not know what years he was president in. But it was essentially the period 1910 to around 1920, whatever, whenever he got elected in that range.
To go back to my other question about why has collectivism brought about so much suffering, and it has. When collectivism is applied by the right, you end up with a kind of either a Mussolini or a Hitler situation. Mm. We must remember that the Nazis were the National Socialist Party, and the fascists in Italy were all about collectivization. They were all about social engineering. The Nazis were all about social engineering and eugenics, which is not only social engineering, but biological engineering. So it's about trying to get people to conform to an ideology on the right. On the left, it's the same. It's also about getting people to conform to an ideology. In that case, it's socialism, Marxism, Leninism, communism. In both scenarios, we end up with millions of people dead. We end up with huge unhappiness. We end up with war. And we end up with societies that regress rather than that progress. Whereas those who seem to apply individual rights seem to thrive. Why do you think that is?
Because it's a better rule and by which to live. And perhaps it's surprising to me, perhaps it's surprising to others, but you can specify this rule that seems to lead to prosperity and well-being and many of the good things we aspire to. You can specify it in a couple of words. No action against me without my consent. And if you could apply that across the board, then an awful lot of these collective organizations would be stripped of their powers. So, for example, even on the roads, the ultimate example of where we absolutely have to have collective rules. Yet, nevertheless, it's been found and pretty much confirmed that when you leave individuals to plot their own route through traffic systems, when you take down the signs and when you remove the robots, not only does the traffic flow improve, but so does the happiness, so to speak, of the drivers.
And their sense of personal responsibility, not only for their own vehicle, but for someone else's.
And the safety factor increases dramatically, and there's lots of...
Because there's no one you can blame. There's no one who's going to come in with third-party insurance or with traffic rules or with complications. In other words, you leave home, and to get to work, you have to be supremely observant. You have to be extremely responsible, and you have to be very thoughtful of others.
Well, load shedding demonstrates this perfectly.
Yeah.
We have this great system of robots all over the country, and then we turn them all off, and the traffic carries on just fine, by and large. And I hadn't...
It's a bit slower, but yeah.
Don't be too sure.
Oh, really?
Don't be too sure. There are circumstances when either the roads are very complex or where the traffic is very heavy. But there are many, many measured circumstances. The net speed of traffic slows down. The rate of throughput goes up.
Hmm.
And just as a somebody visiting Gauteng from a sleepy little town in the Eastern Cape, I had to go through the... William Nicol intersection onto the highway.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Your apologies are accepted during load shedding. And there's just cars coming from all directions. And I was stunned to see such a wonderful proof of everybody looking around, working out whose priority is first.
Mm-hmm.
Very few mean, nasty people taking advantage. Almost none.
Yeah.
And this incredibly complex intersection was working
better than if the robots had been on?
I wouldn't say better, because it falls into that category of extremely complex in environments,
okay, all right,
which may be measured better, but a lot better than when I got there the next day, and all the lights were on, and the traffic police had put a roadblock at the bottom of the on ramp,
and then there was all kinds of hell,
and that was chaos.
Yeah, it's ironic when in South Africa, when we see the traffic police, it usually means more trouble, not more good.
Now, the interesting,
even for law-abiding citizens,
the thing about all of that is this comes largely from Hayek and his belief in spontaneous order, and that is a key part of this kind of the fact that individualism and individuals can work is because spontaneous orders arise and individuals work well within them. The classic example being markets, whereas the vast majority of people who haven't given it as much thought as Hayek believe that the only way you could possibly run the traffic system, for example, is by putting traffic cops everywhere, putting controls everywhere, robots.
Regulation.
Yeah.
Laws.
And when you tell them you might be wrong, they say that's inconceivable.
Yeah. Well, they've also been brainwashed into believing what's good for them because they're part of a system which just accepts a whole lot of things like income tax, for example. But let's just talk, because you mentioned the markets. Let's talk about why individualists, libertarians, prefer the market to determine things, because they're in the market, obviously, than to have it regulated.
Hayek probably gives the best reasons that spontaneous orders arise in markets, which allow you to extremely accurately summarize the vast amount of information in that market down to basically a single variable, the price of goods.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing that it does. It's like a wonder of nature. We should put it up there as the eighth wonder of the world, is that markets do this. But the vast majority of people truly believe that you need a commissar to decide how many left brown boots the government needs to produce in the next annual cycle. And as we found in Russia, this is a complete and utter failure. But the general response of government is, well, we didn't try hard enough. Let's
keep trying until we eventually get it wrong again.
Hire another 10,000 people and see if we can get it right. And does any of that sound vaguely familiar?
Yeah, well, we have that problem. We have a swollen bureaucracy in this country, and we have lots of people who are totally dependent on the state. This idea of being responsible for yourself, which is at the heart of this individual stuff, it isn't necessarily just about what you get from society, but about what you give back to society. A lot of people are happy to take from society, but not necessarily happy to give. I'm curious about how income tax or a tax in general plays into your ideas around libertarianism, individualism. Because if we don't need a big government, we don't need to be paying a lot of tax. How does consent come into that too?
Well, just to take you a step back there,
mm-hmm.
is the market absolutely insists that you will only profit in that market if you provide useful services to others. So you can't sell a product. The price of a product is entirely determined by the buyer.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter how badly I need the money, it just doesn't matter to the market. Have I got a product that is worth buying?
Right. If you sell just a left boot, to put the point that you made earlier as the example, if you just sell one left brown boot on its own, it's highly unlikely you're going to find a buyer.
Absolutely. The price.
And even if you're poor and you're desperate and you've worked really hard on that one left boot.
And almost everybody out there has this misconception, which is if I spent a month working on that boot, I'm entitled to a month's wages. And the reality is, well, in severely socialist societies, they will make an arrangement to give you a month's wages, even though the thing you produced is completely unsaleable and unuseful to the vast majority of the world. Whereas in a free market system, perhaps even steer away from the word capitalist system, in a free market system, you profit if it's useful and you don't if it's not. And I was listening.
So it corrects your behavior so that you become a little smarter about how you spend your time.
Yeah, absolutely. And in this fashion, you essentially get to a system where there is justice for everyone. But you do have to be aware of the signals that the market is sending you. Now, you were asking about tax, and in fact, that is the first thing that falls if you request my consent. In other words, do you have a right to impose a tax on me against my consent?
No.
And we as individualists would say no. Just about everybody else says you've got to be crazy, because otherwise how would anything get done anywhere? And yet there's many examples of successful free market economies with, well, in fact, the most successful economies are those with the lowest tax.
Without doubt.
Yeah. And there are even some where tax is effectively non-existent. And, you know, even in our local context, the most successful country in Africa is 2,000 miles out of Africa. It's Mauritius.
Mm.
They have a 15% flat tax rate across everything, people, companies, everything.
They have no real geography. They've got no space to exploit. They've got no raw materials of any huge consequence to exploit. They have a population that is increasingly trying to smarten itself up in the IQ economy. They're trying to develop products and manufacturing and ideas and sophisticated IT technologies and this kind of thing. That's where the money is, and they're growing as a result faster than anyone else.
It's wonderful. I've been there a couple of times, both from the time when they very nearly became a communist a government to the current time. And their GDP, stand under correction, is about $14,000 to $15,000 per person.
Mm-hmm.
Ours is five or less.
Okay, but then someone on the left might say, well, the problem with you individualists is that no one ends up being equal. And to them, equality, particularly equality of outcome, is hugely important. So it's not good enough that people are free, that they're allowed to pursue their own happiness, that they're allowed to do whatever work is meaningful and gratifying to them, either in an economic way or in a social, psychological, or personal happiness way. That's all good and well, but people will end up unequal at the end of that, and that to them is egregious. That to them is not an acceptable outcome. People must be equal. What do you say to that? And is equality something worth striving for?
It's an absolute pipe dream, in my opinion. And there are so many different ways in which you can demonstrate that we're not equal. You and I, you have more hair than I do. Gee.
Sorry.
Can I get a razor and take some of it off?
No, you can't take my hair and put it on you.
Can I cut some of his hair off and glue it to mine?
Sia's hair, you might. I mean, Sia has more to give, but I don't think he'd be too pleased with that.
But yet,
some people are short, some people are tall.
Some
people are fast, some people are thin.
Not equal, and it's laughable in the vast majority of cases to think that we could make them equal, except for income. Income is the thing where we can force equality.
So what if we all had a universal basic income? Let's say we all got 20,000 rand from the government every month, and we didn't really have to work, and those who did could, and those who didn't want to could just languish on the 20.
That begs the question of where the 20,000 per person would come from.
Okay, but let's imagine it was possible. Let's say we had huge oil reserves that were undiscovered until tomorrow, and the government suddenly found them, like Norway did, or like Venezuela did once. Why would that be so bad?
Because the system under which you operate still remains important. So Norway remains under a essentially free market system where people sell products and get good incomes.
Yeah.
Whereas they don't in Venezuela. In fact, essentially in Venezuela, you can't sell anything anymore.
No.
So the system.
Can't buy anything either.
Yeah. The system under which you operate is vastly important. And that was the conclusion that certainly libertarians have come to over the years, and which is at the core of the individualist movement. What we wanted and I wanted to say was that these are the conditions under which if you operate in line with them, you will be prosperous, fair, and free. And if you go against them, then you have to invoke force, aggression, and violence in order to impose your will on me.
And all right, so let's just go through a couple of statements that libertarians often make, and you tell me whether they need correction or whether or not you're happy with them. So first of all tax is theft. Happy with that?
As a statement, yes. I actually wrote a book whose opening line was, taxation is theft.
Why are so many people, when you present them with that idea, horrified and appalled? They think they are entitled to someone else's fruits of their labor. It's a very bizarre thing, humans. We tend to focus on the rich far, far disproportionately to the way that we focus on the poor. It makes us uncomfortable to focus on the poor, whether we're rich ourselves, poor ourselves, or middle class. But we have billionaires lists. We try to imagine what the world of Bill Gates must be like. We think about how much other people have, and we covet that, and we are embittered and resentful sometimes of that. Where did this idea come from? And maybe it's religious in its origin. The idea that you're entitled to the fruits of someone else's labor, that someone else's work can be shared out, the profits of that work can be shared out to you and everyone else who didn't do the work.
I think it arises because it's such a neat idea. And if there was some way I could oblige you to work eight to five and turn over most of your income to me, I'd go for it.
So in other words, it's just plain greed and laziness.
Well, it's in the nature of human beings.
Yeah, so greed and laziness.
Yeah, if they can get something for nothing, they would go for it.
Uh-huh.
And what we need is a rule which kind of holds them back a little, makes them think twice, but it has to be fair to everybody. This restriction that you do have to place on human nature really must be. And there's many sort of philosophical articles on the criteria you need for fair decisions and that sort of thing. We would like to think that no action against me without my consent is a very fair statement, which says nothing about whether you're male or female or big or small or mm-hmm. rich or poor. Says nothing about any of the adjectives that you use.
That's real. That's practical equality. If you want to talk about equality, is being treated the same.
Yeah. The equality of opportunity, totally important. Equality of outcome, as Jordan Peterson's just so puts it so well, is that's just stupid.
Well, it's not just stupid. It's actually a horrible doctrine, and it leads to huge amounts of suffering and pain and social engineering, which usually hurts families, hurts individuals, destroys businesses, and makes society untenable. But let's leave that alone for a second. So taxes, theft, you're happy with that? In other words, we don't need a government. Is that what you're saying?
There's almost everybody says, what about the poor, the crippled, the blind?
No, first of all, what about national security? What about policing? What about education, health? Yeah. What about those things? If there's no government, how do we take care of those things?
South Africa is such a wonderful example of that proves our point at the moment. Is that we have this huge taxation regime, one of the highest in the world, particularly if you have any money.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we have terrible roads.
Terrible public health care.
Terrible policing.
Absolutely abominable education, which has resulted in people being stupider than they would have been 20 years ago.
And what does everybody who's subject to that do? They go to the private option. So we have probably the best security systems, private security systems in the world,
yep.
Some of the best medical systems, private medical systems in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, nevertheless, that message doesn't seem to get across, which okay. is...
So then let's go back to the point you were going to make about the poor and the weak and the disenfranchised and the disabled. Those people in a society which... is perhaps not as individualist. Those people are lifted by the collective. Those people are helped along. Those people are given charity by government. It's forced charity through taxation, but it's nonetheless a way to give them a social safety net, as some of the leftists like to say. Why is that a problem?
If you look at the vast majority of people who, say, have a son in a wheelchair who's crippled, where does most of his care come from? His immediate family,
mm-hmm.
his somewhat extended family who right. put aside a bit of money for him.
Mm-hmm.
He's looked after commonly by many, many charities.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere in that mix, there may be a government handout as well. But it's, in the vast majority of cases, it's not the most important part of the care of, say, that crippled child in a wheelchair.
Right.
If you took away government, you'd take away one source of income for that family. But all of the other care networks that are absolutely critical to it and which the vast majority of people rely on would remain in place. And there's ample evidence to show that Americans give between 3 and 4 times the amount voluntarily to charity than the U.S. government gives out in the form of aid. Hmm. And the U.S. government is taking that at the point of a gun.
Yeah, so there's the next point that I wanted to get to. The next statement that is made is that government has a monopoly on force, on violence.
Yeah.
I mean, is that true too?
Yes, it is absolutely true, and it is a monopoly that we give them. Mm-hmm. Over the course of many years, society has decided that there's a lot of violence in nature. We need to put in place a force to control it. But they make the mistake of saying that we must use force up front in order to put that in place. And I always say, if you want to truly understand something, try and explain it to a 5-year-old. The classic one is capital punishment.
Mm-hmm.
We are against people killing people, so when we catch them, we kill them. And every child is going to say, that doesn't make sense.
Right.
And much the same with taxation is we're really against people stealing from each other. So what we're going to do is we're going to steal from you so that we can run a group of people who won't steal from you, who will stop other people from stealing from you. And the child is going to say, that doesn't make any sense. I don't know why adults have problems with that.
All right. Well, here's the next axiom that individualists and libertarians like to say, and you've already partially answered this, but perhaps you'd like to elaborate, is that anything the government can do will be better done by an individual or a privatized organization.
Yes.
Don't just use South Africa as an example, just because we've got Eskom and Transnet and SAA and all these other disasters.
Yeah, the classic examples, of course, are Hong Kong, Monaco, Luxembourg,
Singapore,
all of those. Almost zero regulations in place on commercial activities.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have terrible political systems, like Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the issue there. But when you have a good commercial regime in place that is based largely on the market, mm-hmm. on non-aggression, but not acting without consent,
right?
You improve the GDP of your country vastly. And we have so much proof that when you put in collective communist systems, you destroy the GDP of your country.
All right. Another one that comes up often is that the family or the individual or a small group of people with a common interest are usually better served by looking to themselves than by looking to government.
Well, I used to stay on a plot out in Noordkadak. And we had a protocol when there was an incident. And we had an incident about once a month at least.
Mm-hmm.
Of who you would contact in an emergency. And of course, it would be the people around you, your family, is everybody, you know, here and how can we help? And your extended family would be next, and your neighbors, your close neighbors would be next, and the security company that you almost invariably had would be next. And somewhere down around 5 or 6, if you still had time and
was the police
airtime, you might call the police. And I always used to say, and I demonstrated it so many times, if you do call the police, make sure you got plenty of coffee.
All right. How about the right to defend yourself? The right to, first of all, bear arms, the right to fortify your position and to be able to protect yourself from incursions on that and to protect your property from incursions upon it.
Absolutely. Sorry.
No, go on. Have a cough.
There we go. No, the rider to the consent axiom. If you have already aggressed against me, and there's some debate around this, are all bets off? In other words, can I respond to a little girl kicking me in the knee with a burst of AK-47 bullets? Or does the response have to be proportional?
Uh-huh.
And yeah, the vast majority of us would say that if somebody aggresses against you, you may respond to,
right,
to them with a proportional response. Now that is always going to be difficult. You know, what if I've got a 9mm and you've got a 5mm gun, whatever mm-hmm. it may be. That is the last and the most contentious point on our manifesto, which is resolve disputes by jury. And there will always be disputes. At the moment, we rely on the state to resolve those disputes for us. And they
so in that last point, are you saying we don't need the judiciary?
Essentially, yes. Huh. And would you believe the best example of that comes from Africa? If there was a dispute between two people in a tribe, you would gather under a tree at what's called a lekgotla, as far mm-hmm. as I know is the correct term for it.
Mm-hmm.
You would have a couple of village elders who have shown experience in resolving disputes in the past. The two complainants would present their case, and the jury, the elders, would consider it. They'd announce their decision to the local assembled populace, all of whom were sitting around because it was best entertainment in town.
Mm-hmm.
And if the assembled populace sort of didn't like the decision, the jury would go back into process to see where they'd gone wrong against the more or less public opinion.
But isn't that a kind of collectivism almost?
Yeah, yeah. There are many cases in which you can only what should we have for lunch?
Yeah,
it's a decision that can only be taken collectively, unless we all go out and buy our own lunch. So many cases, voting is a good thing. It's a way to resolve a difference. But if I'm a vegetarian and you order steak, you can't force me to eat it. That's the consent axiom.
I see what you mean. Okay. We've got a number of people who've got a few questions here for you, and I'm sure that we'll get to some of those in a second. Let's just talk about the rule of law for a second.
Sure.
Because libertarianism isn't being a libertine or a hedonist. It isn't just fulfilling your own immediate and personal and selfish desires at all costs, even if you have that caveat of don't harm others, because a hedonist isn't necessarily a productive person and isn't necessarily a useful occupant of society.
Well, we're more commonly confused with librarians, as for what it's worth. So when we hold our conferences, we have to make it quite clear it's not a librarian conference. But yeah, so libertines are individuals, and they are absolutely entitled to whatever peculiarities that they desire, so long as consent is involved. And that is a classic example of where the consent axiom beats the non-aggression principle. I really like getting whipped and stoned and all sorts of strange things done to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to have even a libertarian come in and say, no, you can't do that. It involves aggression and violence. So you do have to allow that individual particular choice. And for probably the majority of the world, they would not understand rugby. Why do you allow yourself to be so badly abused and beaten up
yeah.
by opposing teams, and you seem to enjoy it, and lots of people seem to watch it. But for the majority of the world, they'd say, no, this is insanely dangerous. It ought to be banned.
And yet, because of consent, it has become a very popular sport and something which many people seem to enjoy.
Well, all right. most
not all of us, but many of us.
Most people understand consent very well in terms of a referee at a soccer game,
yeah.
for example. Both sides consented to be subject to the decision of the rules of the game and that referee.
Right.
And we get on with it. That works fine.
I mean, we complain bitterly when the referee doesn't decide in our favor, but...
Well, that's when you go to your jury.
I'm curious. The jury's off on the TV, yeah. So I want to go back to this idea of not belonging and belonging, because you've already indicated that through evolutionary psychology, it has been a very good thing to belong, to make yourself a part of the collective, because then you were safer. Mm. You were more successful because you could hunt things. You could live in a peaceful society. If you all opted into a collective, then the chances of that collective turning into a village, turning into a city, turning into a country were improved and enhanced. But we do live in a different time now. We live in a time where we don't have to fight an external threat of violence to the degree that our ancestors did. Mm. And we're not forced to cooperate in places where maybe our consent wasn't always required before. Now it certainly, you would assume, in most civilized parts of the world, it is. With great exceptions. But why is it that there are people who still want to be told what to do, still want to be thought of as objects by others, and be commanded around as objects, be engineered into certain kinds of societies according to the will of an elite? And then there are people like me who don't want to belong to anything. We don't want to be thought of as being... Don't impose any label on me I haven't chosen for myself, is basically what it is. How do you manage to
reconcile
these?
There's a great book by a Canadian psychologist who is not Jordan Peterson, but I can't remember his name offhand, called Authoritarians.
Yes.
And he has devoted his life to trying to answer that question. Why do people become authoritarians? But even more importantly, why do people subject themselves to the will of other authoritarians? And it's a very worthwhile read, quite a long read. Mm-hmm. And he comes to the conclusion that 80% of people are quite happy to be subject to authoritarians and to be told what to do. So the vast majority of the population does accept the will of authoritarians, and that's why we have tax, and that's why we have democracies the way we currently have them. Is, yes, it's also in human nature to, if you were in the hunting party, tracking down a mammoth, you really had to have some guy
who was in charge,
who said, go left, go right, you five there, you six there. And it was just in the nature of things that a majority of people would subject themselves to his rule. However, and it's a key characteristic of hunter-gatherer societies, if he made one or two bad decisions,
he was replaced.
And if he wasn't replaced, you just walked away. You packed up your goods and you took your family and you went off in a new direction. And you probably became the new leader of the mammoth hunt for a group that you gathered around yourself. And that was very civilized, essentially. You didn't have to fight.
There's consent involved here.
Yeah. You didn't have to have a war. But then we all settled down and we lived in huge walled towns and we had massive fields that we had to protect from the invading hordes and that sort of thing. And the idea of authoritarians then became cemented into our society. And there's a couple of good books that pretty much say that what everybody else described as the dawn of our civilization was kind of the end of our civilization.
So you think there's almost this idea of this heroic hunter-gatherer who is somehow lost, that we've given something up. We've given up that liberty that he might have had.
Well, certainly we've given up the liberty to just up and walk away. And
yeah, you can't opt out of society. I mean, there's no conceivable way that you can say, this is not my government. I refuse to partake in it.
Oh, there's many, many.
I refuse to pay my taxes. You'll get locked up.
Well, in this particular society, at this particular time, yes. But, I mean, South Africa is a wonderful example of a succession of seceded states. So, for example, in 1910, the South Africa seceded from the
Union. They became the Union.
From the British Empire,
right?
Yeah.
So we said, we don't want Queen Victoria anymore.
Yeah.
We got out.
And while we were doing that, two little parts, very much part of South Africa, said, no, we won't go with that. Lesotho and Swaziland went a different way.
That's right. They opted out.
Yeah. They were the hunter-gatherer that said, no, we're not going with – that doesn't look like a good plan to us.
And then you also had that breakaway between the, well, this was probably predating that, but it was there was the old Free State Republic, which was different to the Transvaal Republic.
Two of them. There were two really good examples of what we would call not quite libertarian, but non-authoritarian. One of the Free State Republics refused to ever elect a president, for example, because the farmers would not agree. And that's kind of why they got overrun pretty quick.
Well, now you've got King Goodwill Zwelithini and the Khoisan in the Cape who are saying, well, we're threatened to secede from this current republic if, for example, expropriation without compensation goes ahead. You've got Orania in the center of South Africa where people have decided they've declared themselves a separate entity. They're not entirely a separate state. They don't necessarily have sovereignty.
Well, my personal opinion is that is the next big series of events for South Africa.
Secession.
Will we keep a unitary state in the face of the many, many challenges that unitary state has got? And one of my great criticisms of this government, and I have many, is that they won't allow significant competition to their ideas. My suspicion is they're so insecure in the value of their ideas that to allow any alternative to stand up and thrive might undercut them entirely. So,
give me an example.
You, for example, cannot establish a development zone in which the labor laws do not apply. You cannot suspend the labor laws in this country. They apply anywhere and everywhere.
Universally.
Whether or not they're a good idea. Now, wouldn't it be great if you could? I've often said, give me one square mile of any township in South Africa and allow me to suspend all of the civil law in that we'll maintain the criminal law, etc. Allow me to suspend the civil law, and that one square mile will be the richest part of South Africa, as rich as Sandton within, I would say, 1 to 3 years. Everybody says, no, what a load of nonsense. And I say, well, first thing I had to suspend is all the banking laws. Okay, so you can transact how you like in my one square mile. And every single bank in this country would move its head office to that one square mile.
Yes, because they wouldn't have the onerous regulations that they have in the rest. So first of all, you'd have all the banks move in then.
And they would employ lots of people. There would be huge inflows of capital in and out through that environment. You would also suspend the labor laws.
So in other words, just pure supply and demand. Someone wants to work, someone wants to employ, you've got a deal. Someone doesn't want to work, someone doesn't want to pay that amount, no deal.
You'd suspend all tariffs. So you could buy all that wonderful stuff
on Amazon or on eBay or from China or whatever and bring it in and send your stuff out.
Without the $45 surcharge. I've just bought something and I was horrified that it was a fifth of the total cost was South African tax.
Okay, so that's three things already that have made it possible for your square mile to thrive.
Yeah, and I don't think you need even more than one of them.
Yeah, totally true.
To make it incredibly
so when is libertarianism going to have its day? I mean, it seems to me that we're constantly having to fluctuate between left and right, and all they're offering us is more collectivism. When is it going to be individualism and libertarianism's turn?
We have this huge problem. We're against violence. We're against aggression. All of our opponents use it as the first resort. So we tend to lose most battles that involve any form of aggression or violence. So, for example, if I said, I'm putting up a wall around my 1 square kilometer or plot, the first thing that the state would do is show up with many armed men on my borders.
And threaten you.
And threaten me. And we're not very good at responding to that. Sometimes, there are some kind of conservative groups, both in South Africa and in America, who would espouse most of the libertarian philosophy, but are kind of like arming themselves and preparing themselves.
Well, this is interesting because the reason that so many Americans claim the Second Amendment is important to them is because they have the right to bear arms, not against each other, And not against an external threat, but against their own government, should their own government turn into a tyranny.
That's absolutely what Jefferson said in forming the Second Amendment was, this is to...
We have practically lived through a tyranny of Jacob Zuma. It has denuded the country of many of its most valuable assets. It's reduced the capacity of the state, first of all, which should alarm statists, but second of all, the economy at large and therefore individuals in their ability to, you know, to interact with the rest of the world. We've lived under that tyranny. We had no mechanism by which to bring it back to heel.
We do actually have some good
civil society.
Yep. One of the tasks or ambitions of the individualist movement, and just to diverge slightly, we're trying to be more proactive. We're trying to undertake projects that will bring about what we think is a good world. And currently we have two big projects in place. One of them is to organize a conference of civil society organizations in South Africa with a belief in freedom. And about 2 months ago, I went through every website I could find that had the word freedom or liberty in its heading. And I found 50. Which is quite interesting. I mean, you know, some of them are the Human Rights Commission, which is a bit dodgy in terms of its dedication to individual freedom, but
sure.
so be it. But they're on our website at, if I may throw this in.
Go on.
www.individualist.co.za. You'll find a list of...
Quite like that it's a long word, so you know, if someone's silly can't type it in because they don't know how to spell, they won't join.
We're not that elitist, but nevertheless, our idea was to bring together these civil society organizations. It has proved to be extraordinarily difficult. So it's kind of not happening at this point in time, but we will persevere. But very much the purpose of the individualist movement is to try and translate, some of these good ideas into practical programs in the real world. So,
what's the libertarian take on drugs, or on alcohol, or on cigarettes?
Do you put them in your mouth with your consent?
Sure.
Then go ahead.
What is the libertarian position with regard to euthanasia, or being able to decide that you've had enough and it's time for them to switch off your machines?
Do you own your own life?
Or you own your own body, you own your own meat, yes.
Yes, and if you do, then your decision to terminate it is still yours. And no bunch of do-gooders should get into that discussion. But the almost all of these answers would come back to, do you as an individual have consent, the right to your own body and resources? And a very important part of this is your right to property. What is the word? Recognize the property that I own. And we're right in the middle of, you know, completely going against that concept at the moment.
Yeah, dear, that what you own isn't even yours.
Yeah.
The government can do with it, dispose of it as it will.
Well, 40% of what's in your wallet is not yours.
That's true. Gets taken out before you even get to touch it.
Yeah. So, what we're doing here is, I suppose, a part of this process is just trying to expose some of these bad ideas that we are so easily subject to. And the interesting thing is that libertarianism has grown rather remarkably since I first entered it. I got involved in 1985 at the first libertarian seminar.
Mm-hmm.
We have held one every year since then. So we've had 33 seminars with the exception of 1 year. Now, there's almost no other organization that I'm aware of that has out-survived the apartheid government, the nationalist government, the several presidencies under the ANC government. We've out-survived all of those, and we're still going on. And we had
and growing? More or less static.
Probably more or less static. We've been at
so
about
that's the problem, right?
Four or 500 people who are on our mailing list for a long time.
And just quickly to go full circle on this, Ayn Rand, why is she regarded by some as such a pariah? and is such a dangerous thinker. When you go to the trouble of reading her own story, mm-hmm. it would seem to me that even the most hard left person would appreciate that she had been through a lot in order to inform her decisions about what she wrote later on.
Amongst many other things, she was brutally honest. So if she thought you were stupid, she'd call you stupid. And that's pretty much what she was saying about the mainstream media back in around about 1955 when Atlas Shrugged came out. One of the most evil persons in that book is the journalist. I can't remember his name, but the journalist who represents essentially the mainstream media. But she was brutally honest, and she would say things that were anathema, I suppose, to most of the more or less civilized America of that time. And I think that's one of the reasons that she's unpopular. She wasn't right about everything. She had some very strange ideas about human relations and that sort of thing.
Yeah, particularly familial and sexual relations.
But just about every libertarian comes to this way of thinking because of her, myself included. My book was The Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal.
Wow.
And I was a deeply wet liberal. I was a member of NUSAS and all those sorts of things at university. Mm-hmm. And then I read this book and just did a flip-flop sort of overnight.
Well, they say that if you're young and you don't have a heart and you aren't liberal – well, if you're young and you aren't liberal, you don't have a heart.
Yes.
If you're old and you're not conservative, you don't have a brain.
Yep.
But maybe the libertarians can espouse the best of those somewhere in the middle.
Well, most of us do start out as wet liberals. Because I think it's just built into our genetics to kind of care for society and care for how it's going to turn out and care for what our children are going to grow up in. And it's not good enough just to sit back and say, well, the government will look after it. You know, a bunch of not terribly well qualified, grossly overpaid bureaucrats are actually responsible for the most important aspects of my life.
Yeah.
We don't go with that.
You'd rather take that on personally?
Yes.
Okay, I love it. I don't have any disagreement with any of the things that you've said, Trevor, so I wanted to be devil's advocate for some of it at least. But I think this has been fascinating. I'm sure we'll talk again soon, but keep up the good work.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Trevor Watkins, the co-founder of the individualist movement, cliffcentral.com.
This is cliffcentral.com.